Hello, and welcome to episode 1 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panelists include local judge, tournament organiser, and contributor to the Australian Tabletop Gaming Network, Thomas Daniel, runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals, Liam Prasad, two-time store champion and two-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor Wilfie Horrig, and 2014 Adelaide Regional Champion and 2014 Australian National Champion, Jesse Marshall. I'm Brian Holland, 2014 Australian Nationals Top 8 competitor. How's everyone doing?
Very well.
Yeah, we're great.
Excellent. Just mentioning Nats there, I thought we could maybe start off there. Tom, you ran that event, so can you give us a bit of a recap as to your perception of how things went?
Yeah, sure. So I guess the first thing to say is that the size of the event was off the scale. Melbourne's never really had anything like that in terms of Netrunner before. 80 people was the final number, 80 competitors. And yeah, it was a great day. I think we ended up doing 7 rounds of Swiss, cut to a top 8. We had to shorten it down to about 55-minute rounds, but we ended up getting through most of them without any trouble. In general, in terms of the calls that I got from a judge perspective, it was all pretty straightforward stuff. Not too much in the way of, you know, disagreements. People were very civil, which is always a plus. Top 8 went off pretty well, and, you know, most of you guys were there.
Yeah, that was really sweet.
That was a good day.
Yeah, Liam, you actually topped the Swiss. Mm-hmm. You were number one going into double elimination. How was that little adventure for you?
It felt really good. I was on the bubble for a long time there. This happens with almost every large Netrunner event because people just seem to end up on a very similar number of points towards the end of the event. I was out of contention almost, and then ended up winning my last 4 games in a row.
Oh, wow.
Coming in top of the Swiss. I feel really bad for the guy who crushed at the end in the finals, actually, because we were just on that cusp where if both of us won a game, if we split, we possibly could have both not made it. But he was actually top of Swiss, lost the 6th round flat, lost the 7th round flat to me, ended up coming in, I think, 10th. So just got completely dream crushed out of it. But that said, I feel absolutely fantastic.
That's the most important thing.
Yeah, like, net utility remained constant.
Yeah, of course. And as I mentioned earlier, we've actually got Jesse Marshall with us, who won the event. Jesse, how are you feeling?
Yeah, pretty great. It was a really enjoyable day. As Tom said, people played in really good spirits all day. It was great to see so many interstaters coming along. I'm not sure how many we had, about 20, 25, I think, out of the 80.
I think it's probably sitting somewhere between 20 and 30.
Yeah, which was a really huge effort from people around the country to get down to Melbourne. So that was kudos to them. In terms of my day, it started off, we did about a week of testing beforehand amongst us, all of us guys. And I was really torn between Near Earth Hub and Wayland. I'd had really good results with Wayland, but I hadn't played a tournament with Wayland for months. And what probably tipped me over the edge into playing it was the inclusion of Lotus Field, which I'll talk a bit more about later. But I ended up going with that, and that worked out really well. I didn't lose a game with that all day. I didn't have so much success with my runner deck. I think I had about a 50-50 record in Swiss with runner. Struggled against Near Earth Hub, which is really, really powerful. In general, played against some really good players, played against quite a lot of Near Earth Hub on the co-op side, and a really diverse runner metagame. But it was a good day.
You had the only Wayland deck, right?
I think there may have been one other person playing Grindel, but I think
there was 3 Wayland decks out of 80.
Yep.
And the other 2, I believe, were Grundle.
Yeah. I probably up until about 2 months ago, when Wraparound and Sweeps Week and I'm trying to think, I guess when those cards came together and I felt like NBN went over the edge, and an EPD contract actually was what pushed it over the edge. And for a while, I sort of thought you can't play an EPD contract in Wayland because it's too much bad publicity. An EPD contract, such a good agenda, you've just got to play other decks. So I had been playing NBN, but I sort of did a bit of testing with an EPD contract in Wayland, and I think we're going to talk about this a bit later as well. Found that it was fine, and that was another reason that I got pushed back to it. Yeah.
Excellent. Going on that segue into our first deck tech for the episode, as stated, I think a lot of players might have called you a bit of a madman for going with Wayland Scorched over Near Earth Hub, Fast Advance. So just spend a little bit of time talking about your Corp deck in a bit of detail, Jesse. Maybe cover some of the advantages and disadvantages you see, and perhaps we'll start with how you play the deck. What's your overall strategy?
Sure. My general philosophy with co-op decks has been for quite a while that I like to have more than one avenue to win. I don't like just relying on agenda points. Not necessarily that you'll always use the other avenue or always even try and use it, but just having that threat for the runner really changes the way they play. So I've liked Wayland because obviously you've got Scorched Earth, which is an alternate win condition. And even when I started playing NBN, I liked including Shinobi in my deck for that alternate route to victory. So with this deck particularly, some of the things that made me decide that Wayland was viable again, I said earlier, Lotus Field. What I was finding a lot of the time was that in the mid game, runners had become so efficient that you just really couldn't keep them out of any servers. Lotus Field has changed that because Wayland doesn't have any good in-faction code gates, and all the code gates that you could splash, Tollbooth is probably the best. Was probably the best splash. It was two influence, firstly, which is steep, but also the eight res cost was too high. Having an ice that costs five rather than eight that does a stopping job as a reasonably large code gate is huge. But the other thing that Lotus Field does is it punishes Data Sucker. So it means that your opponent's rig is not going to be as efficient as it otherwise would be, which is absolutely huge. So Lotus Field is one thing, NAPD Contracts is the other one. I mentioned earlier that NAPD Contracts was one of the reasons I stopped playing Wayland because I thought it was unviable with the amount of bad publicity you rack up in Wayland. The only cards I've got in this deck that give you bad publicity are Hostile Takeovers. You can't not run those. They're too good with Archer and they're too good generally. Two for ones are just too valuable.
Jesse, did you find it all throughout the day that having that bad publicity stifled you a little bit when it came to your NAPDs? Or were you just never planning to score those?
Only very late. I did score probably two or three NAPD contracts throughout the day. And with the amount of taxing servers that you, so with the amount of tax you can place on the runner in a remote server between Archer and Lotus Field, it is really expensive in the mid game for them to try and steal an NAPD contract. So there are a lot of windows where you can quite confidently place one in that remote server. And even if they do take it, they've put themselves so low that you've got them hopefully within scorched range if you've got that in hand.
I agree completely. Between the massive sentry that is Archer and just the unyoggable, undata-suckerable Lotus Field, it really is a just a new class of ice in itself, and the two of them are easily the most unassailable types of ice to try and go through.
With the game plan, that's a good segue, Liam. People might have seen in the videos from the top eight that have been posted, I often tried to set up remote servers, including at least an Archer and a Lotus Field, and then one other piece of ice on the outside if you're playing against a deck that's going to have inside jobs. And it, once you've got that Archer and that Lotus Field in the remote, you're in a pretty good position. I
How
don't.
worried, sorry, Jesse, how worried are you when you're playing expensive ice like Archer? How worried are you about cards like Emergency Shutdown?
Emergency Shutdown is definitely a pain. It's one of the cards that I least like seeing. I guess if you're playing against Criminal, you're wanting to defend HQ probably quite strongly anyway. You want to try and keep them out as long as possible. And you're probably going to put some big ice there. So what I generally try and do is not res Archer unless I absolutely have to. And I try and have archers. The reason I play three, some people might question that as well, but the reason I play three is I like to have them all on the board as early as possible. Even if you've only got one hostile takeover scored that you're willing to forfeit, being able to have the flexibility to res it anywhere is absolutely huge.
Obviously, everything's situational, but are you ever throwing a 2-point agenda to an archer or not?
Very, very rarely. I don't think that the boosts that you get from Archer, in terms of tempo, is big enough that it outweighs a 2-point agenda. Like generally, you might be able to score one more 2-point agenda in that window if you're lucky. Generally not. I think it puts you too far behind. My primary game plan remains scoring agendas out. I will try very hard to force the runner to waste credits. early so that I can find a window to score a government contract. And then once you've got that, that or an Atlas overscored, and once you've got that, you're in a pretty decent position to threaten them with Scorched, but also push out other agendas.
How many games did you actually win with Scorched throughout on Nationals?
I think two. I won two games with Scorched Earth and one game with Snares. Snare is the third card that made me want to play Wayland again, because I was finding in our testing that Near Earth Hub was very weak to Legwork. That Legwork was one of the strongest cards, and that I was expecting a lot of people would be playing Legwork and playing Criminal. And Snare is just so good against Legwork. And then, fortunately, in my first round, or unfortunately for my opponent, I got Legworked on about turn five, and he hit two Snares and died. So that was... I felt vindicated at that point for my deck choice. Yeah, yeah. But...
Well, yeah, that's bad for him, but good for you in terms of a major tournament like that, I suppose. You mentioned quite a few integral cards to the deck, but one I just wanted to brush on, because I think maybe doesn't get as much attention as some big cards like Archer... but Power Shutdown.
Yeah.
Did that card put in work for you?
Yeah, it's a really huge card. I've said this, I think, a number of times on various internet forums and things, that it is really hard to squeeze utility cards into your corp deck between Money, Ice, Agendas, and Jackson, etc. It's really hard to squeeze more aggressive cards into your deck, and obviously Scorched Earth package also takes up a lot of deck space. So Power Shutdown, I think... it's a really powerful card because there aren't many co-op cards that you can play on your turn that interact with the runner's rig. And it does it in a really efficient way. It hits some of the most annoying cards for you, as in the Wayland player, in a really efficient way. So you can kill fairies without trashing any cards just for one credit, and that is massive for opening up those scoring windows where you've got the archer on the board. Particularly with, if you've got three unres dice on a remote and you trash one of their fairies, even if they've got one more fairy or one clone ship, they're probably going to be unwilling to run into that in case there's two archers. And that situation came up a number of times. But also trashing data suckers is just massive.
Yeah.
Given how many criminals there were on the day, did you ever feel like you wanted more Power Shutdown?
Yes and no. I think the deck was balanced really well. One thing I guess that's worth noting is that we've got six sentries, five code gates, and five barriers. I think having a good split of ice types in your deck is really important. But also having enough economy cards, like playing the three hedge fund, three restructure, three beanstalk, you really want to be seeing one of those in the first turn. So yeah, I mean, it would be nice to have another Power Shutdown, but I can't really see the space there for cutting.
For sure.
Sure, excellent. And just segueing into the next part of the deck tech, throughout your day, when your opponent as runner notices that you're playing Scorched, did you generally notice a difference in the way that they began to play? Were they perhaps more scared of Scorched sometimes than they should have been?
Yes and no. I think... when I play against Wayland, I basically don't run in the early game. I just try and build my rig, try and dig for a Plascrete, and then once I've got a Plascrete, I go aggro.
You just run with impunity then?
Yeah. Obviously, you have to stay above four cards in hand, so it's not impunity.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing. When playing Wayland, when you see a Plascrete, are you just like, well, now I'm going for a gender victory?
Yep, definitely. The only way that you cannot is through their bad play. If they run into a snare on their fourth click and can't clear the tag, that's pretty much the only way. That and triple scorched. So yeah. The other card that's notable is Taurus as well. That's sort of a way that you can get back into the game in that position. It's unlikely. I mean, I've got into situations, not at this tournament, but at other tournaments with this deck where, you know, you're playing against Chaos Theory, who's got a Magnum Opus turn one, and they just build up masses of money and masses and all the breakers they need, and there's not really much you can do as the corp. At that point, you've really got to hope they make a mistake, but that's going to be a problem with any corp deck.
Yeah, it sounds like an excellent metagame selection for a criminal metagame, though. If your tough matchups are going to be the very fast rig developing control style shapers, I can see where you won.
And just briefly, Jesse, do you have any more advice for people when they're playing against Wayland what the overall plan should be.
Yeah, I think it's really important to check ice early on central servers. I had a lot of players who didn't face check any ice. I mean, you're not going to trigger off Seasource unless you make the successful run. Pay attention to how much money the Wayland players got. A lot of people did try, you know, variations on this strategy, like running very little, building up money as much as they could. But I guess the other important thing, and this is what I play Kate with multiple R&D access options, you've got to have a way that you can punish them quite quickly when you do start running. So not only do you have to build up a rig, but you've got to have a way that you can try and get to seven reasonably quickly once you do start being aggressive. Otherwise, you've very likely given them one or two agendas early. So otherwise, you're going to lose the game, basically. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, as we mentioned, Nationals was a very criminal-heavy metagame, and I think some of the best runner decks at the moment are criminal. So moving into our next deck tech, both Wilfie and Liam were playing Andromeda at Nationals. Their lists were slightly different. Let's start. Wilfie, what can you say about playing Andromeda?
Oh, yeah. Hey, what's up? So I chose to play Andromeda because I think it's the best. That sounds kind of obvious, but not only is it the best because I think it's the strongest, but it's also the most consistent. Like, I had someone ask me, my friends who was new to the game ask me, why is Andromeda so good? Because it doesn't, I know, maybe to most people who are listening, it's probably obvious, but just the ability to play cards in your deck that are good early and almost guarantee that you're going to have some combination of them early means you can focus your game plan very effectively. So I think it's this combination of power and consistency, and also your opponent. Andromeda is such a diverse identity that your opponent doesn't really know what strategy you're going to have. And that's why me and, I think you mentioned it, Brian, that me and Liam had small differences, but they have a large impact because your opponent has to play around them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found exactly this the same style. Essentially just having three Desperados and three Data Suckers and nine cards to see them in any combination with security testing to try and turn on an early game economy, or even just three special orders, finding your breakers early, exactly the break you need, and being able to access with legwork or account siphon. Just the number of ways you can be aggressive and threatened there. It's good selection. We did have a few differences, and I did really find that they made a big difference. I play an Atman over a Mimic and a Kuroda. Normally we'll play two Kurodas and a Mimic and a Yogg in those breaker slots, and I chose to remove a Kuroda and a Mimic to fit in an Atman, and it was massive. The Atman was absolutely massive. Being able to have a Kuroda for all the small barriers and the Atman for the Eli, or just have Atman for the Loithers field, leaving your Yogg to do the rest of the go-get work was absolutely fantastic. Very efficient rig.
Wilfie, no doubt that you thought about including Atman in your deck at some point. Can you shed some light on why you chose not to and the advantages or disadvantages thereof?
Yeah, the problem is that the influence is just too tight. There's so many things that you want to add, and you can really take the deck in a lot of different directions, but I found that this configuration was the one that worked best. And, like, if you cut Mimic, then there are other Sentry Breakers which do similar things, but none which do so at the efficiency that Mimic does.
Yeah, I ended up having to play the Ninja, which was fine. It goes through Rotherwise effectively. So
you don't find the cost of it to be stifling
to
at all?
To be prohibitive? Yeah, it's definitely prohibitive. I also play the third Fairy.
Okay. So.
Wilfie, when we were testing, I think you found that you didn't have a passport in your deck initially, and you decided to include one, mostly for Lotus Field. Did you want to maybe talk about that a bit?
Yeah, that turned out to be really good, but I think not because of Lotus Field. Like, I actually played against maybe one Lotus Field through the whole day, which I don't know if that tells you something, but who knows. But just having a second Codegate Breaker that was especially good against Lotus Field, and good in some situations where Yogg wasn't, especially the fact that it costs one instead of five means you can cast it and be aggressive earlier, I found that that was more important than the fact that it got past Lotus Field. But still, the primary reason to include it is because you need a good way to deal with Lotus Field, and Passport is a really good way, I think.
Yeah. Another difference in both Liam and Wolfie's decks is Liam has included a decoy instead of a Plascrete, and Wolfie has neither decoy nor Plascrete. So I know a lot of players would balk at your option to not include any anti-scorched cards in your deck, Wolfie. What's your general game plan when you're up against scorched?
Well, I think Jesse covered this in that you can win just by sitting there. Like, if I had thought that Wayland was going to be, like, not necessarily Wayland, but decks with Scorched Earth, but specifically slow decks with Scorched Earth. Like, for example, there are fast decks with Scorched Earth, but Plascrete isn't as important against them because you can just win a longer game by just sitting there. But especially slow decks with Scorched Earth, they can outpace your professional contacts, which is the main plan against those kind of decks. And so Plascrete would have been important there. But I think that given the metagame representation, I would still agree with my decision not to include a Plascrete. A decoy, I think, could have been a possibility, but I think that it's not necessary a lot of the time because it's a bit situational. But, of course, if that situation comes up, you can find that it's very good.
I think it was the right call. I think that since regional season, we've seen a massive decline in general Wayland play, but also Scorched play. So, but in saying that, you know, maybe that's the exact same reason that you would play Wayland, is because people are starting to cut down on their anti-Scorched tech.
I was just going to say that it can be right to not play cards that are good against Scorched, and also to play Scorched, and these can happen at the same point. Like, it's not that one of these things can be wrong. And, of course, Jesse reaped the benefits of this situation, but it's not necessarily the case that, you know, if Wayland is good, you should play Plascrete. Wayland has to be good, and also lots of people have to think it's good.
And there was another difference, and I'm just going to say one word to Liam here. Infiltration?
Oh, yeah. Infiltration is very good.
It's still good?
I don't like how quickly it loses to Ziabatsu loyalty.
Oh, yes. But,
no, Infiltration was excellent for me over the course of the day. There were lots of situations where I didn't want to lose my rig, particularly because I didn't have a second Kuroda. I just didn't want to lose things to aggressive secretaries, to long lines, or run into a face-down snare or something like that. Having options to just be aggressive and not need to feel like you're taking a risk is good for me.
Sure, you're only playing one copy of the card. Would you say, like, on average through the day, how many times were you using the credit mode versus the expose mode?
Normally just the credit mode. I've got a pair of same old things as well, so if I do need it as the game goes longer, I can access it with the same old thing. And that's exactly the time you would actually need it. If the game does go longer, if there is a high cost to accessing a server, or if there is a high risk to running into a face-down archer when you don't have any fairies left.
Yeah.
Having
that's
these,
exactly the time you need it.
Having these utility one-offs with same old thing is, I think, a really big deal. And it's it's probably the sign that of a very well-thought-out deck if you are including it for those reasons.
Hmm. I do regret including the decoy, though. It is very different from the Plascrete. And I think over the day, I was much more worried about mid-seasons a lot of the time, which decoy is completely useless against.
Sure. Well, so is Plascrete in that sense.
Well, you don't have to avoid the tag.
All right, sure.
To not get scorched. So yeah. The mid-season scorched decks, you want a Plascrete.
Yeah. The other difference is Wolfie's list is not playing same old things, but you are playing three Express Delivery. Wolfie, how's that card been treating you?
Yeah, it's been really good. I think Express Delivery and Same Old Thing do kind of the opposite thing, because Express Delivery is good early and Same Old Thing is good late, and so I found that was really good to have Express Delivery in your opening hand, or to draw it early. Having it in your opening hand is best, because then if you cast it on turn, play it on turn 2 or turn 3, then it lets you sculpt your game plan, lets you find the cards that you're missing from your opening hand, and the power of Andromeda is to be able to find cards very consistently, and so Delivery really helps with that. It's a bit inefficient, but you don't always have to cast it, and when you do, I find it quite powerful. Brian, you played the same list as I did, so
I very much enjoy Express Delivery. Just pretty much for the reasons you say, like, one of my favorite things is with Andromeda, you're starting off with 9 cards. If one or even 2 of them is an Express Delivery, You can win entire games without ever having to click to draw a card, which feels so fantastic. And I think with Andromeda, when you're playing a particularly aggressive runner list, that's definitely where you want to be. You don't want to be clicking for cards. If you can win off that first nine, it's just fantastic, even if you only have to tutor a couple of times or just look at the top four to see what you need. So for that reason, I probably prefer it to Same Old Thing, but... obviously.
Same old thing definitely aims for the longer game, which is what I ended up tailoring for a lot of the time anyway. Not having the second Crota, not having a passport, having to rely on Yogg to break code gates, and having to rely on an Atman to go through a lot of barriers effectively because of the lack of Crota, meant that my games did tend to go a little bit longer, but I played pretty quickly. So
yeah.
So even with the 55 minutes, I felt really, really comfortable.
Yeah. So what do you think contributed to the speed of your play? Do you think it was the amount of testing you did, knowing your deck?
Or... practice is definitely a big part of it. Yeah, if you practice a lot. And also, I was very tired. I hadn't slept very much, so I wanted to play as little Netrunner as possible, which I know sounds counterintuitive considering it was a 12-hour day.
Yeah.
And by the time we played all the way to the finals, it was a 12-hour day.
Yeah.
But, you know, I spent two-thirds of it on my butt, so...
Sure. While we're on that, I think there's a bit of a misconception amongst some newer players that in order to play fast games, especially for a tournament or to finish your rounds earlier, you need to be playing a fast deck like Near Earth Hub, Fast Advance, or Andromeda, which I don't think is the case. Like, Jesse, like, traditionally Wayland isn't particularly a very fast deck, but I've seen you play and I've played against you, and you do play quite fast. Like, well, what sort of advice do you have to people when it comes to just, you know, making their decisions and doing so at an efficient time?
Yeah, I think it's knowing your deck is really it. As I said, we spent about a week of solid testing every day or every couple of days before the event. And before then, you know, I've played this a very similar deck to this Wayland deck many times before at tournaments. And yeah, you really just need to be able to plan your turns in advance in your head. You need to know what your opponent is likely to do. You need to know, you know, when you draw your card as the corp, for your first click, you need to pretty much know what you're going to do, and you should be able to do it within 30 seconds. There's no reason, particularly on early turns where there's not a lot of different things that you are likely to want to do, you should be able to get through those turns really, really quickly.
Yeah, I agree. Tom, just in terms of speed of play and things like that, did you notice any really disparity in the tournament when it came to people going to time versus people... at the regular time?
No, I think it was kind of the to be expected percentages of people. You know, you see a lot of people maybe on the lower tables were going to time. That's not necessarily due to skill. Maybe it's people enjoying themselves a bit more or taking it a bit more casual, knowing that they don't have to, you know, battle it out for a top eight spot. But you know, I'd say we'd have maybe three to four games going to time, which, when you have 40 games, is I think that's pretty good. It's pretty impressive.
There's definitely a point. There's definitely a point in the player capacity where every round's going to go the time, just because one table certainly has to if you just put that many players in the room. Although it's certainly not to do with skill why people at the lower tables would be going to time. I know that towards the top tables, it is incredibly important to get that extra point, and the only way to get the extra point is not to be ahead on the draw. So whether it's 45 minutes or 50 minutes or 55-minute rounds, you simply need to win before the clock ticks up.
I will say one other thing about this, and that is that even though I was playing two slow decks, like my Kate deck is reasonably slow generally, and the Wayland deck was slow, the decks I played against in general were fast. So you do generally play to the fast end of what your slow deck's capable of when you're playing against fast decks. You know, when I played against a replicating perfection deck with my Kate deck, we both played very slow and our round nearly went to time. So yeah, it is a product of the metagame as well as the way you play, but you can definitely do the little things as a player to try and make sure your rounds go faster.
And particularly if you wanted to do well in the tournament, as Liam was saying, get that extra point. I think those little things, however, you know, infinitesimal they may seem, can really add up toward the end of the tournament. Yeah. Going into the double elimination,
definitely going to time isn't some situation ordained by some external force. Going when you go the time in the round is because both players decided to. So yeah, we just need to make the decision to be faster at plays.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks so much to everybody for taking the time out of your day to share some information with our listeners. So next week we'll be coming back weekly with this podcast as we're going forward. In the meantime, if you have any questions or anything you'd like us to discuss on the podcast, we'd really love to hear from you. One thing we do really want to do with this podcast is engage with the Netrunner community. You can get us at thewinningagenda@gmail.com. Or alternatively, you can hit us up on Facebook if you have us on Facebook, any of us, and we can certainly pass that on. We'll look forward to hearing you. So,
thanks for listening.
No problem. Thanks for listening, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
See ya.